Thank you for joining us for our market update call. Joining us on the call today is Craig Bolanos, founder and CEO of Wealth Management Group. Craig, the call is yours.
Thank you, Lisa, and good morning to everybody all across the country from your friends at the Wealth Management Group. We thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to visit with us just some 2.5-3 weeks past our most recent market update call, and we thought it was important to continue to stay visible, to make sure you know and stay connected to your money. And by now, everyone is aware that we just experienced the single fastest market decline ever recorded in history. You know, bear markets that normally take some 7-8 months to accomplish, we just manufactured one inside of 3.5 weeks. And while it's shocking to the system, because the speed, it just seems irregular, I don't know, maybe that speed is actually the new routine. And what I mean by that is I hearken back to the summer of 2011, when the U.S. went from AAA to AA, and it was the fastest correction ever recorded. And then in 15, it was the fastest correction ever recorded. And then in 18, we underwent the fastest 19.8% drop in modern times. So maybe we shouldn't be too surprised by what unfolded here. But, you know, together we know in every plot, you know, that being the coronavirus, you know, there's a subplot or maybe several subplots, those being cascading oil prices and, of course, demand and supply chain disruption, if not destruction. And I think back to great investors, famed investors like Warren Buffett, you know, who I saw on TV this week reminding us that what we've undergone just now was a stomach punch, not a knockout blow, a stomach punch. And there is going to be light on the other side, just as there has always been. And I wanted to start off this call by making sure we shared with you some of what we've done, you know, what's already in place, and what the strategy is from here. And going into the year, you know, we anticipated a slowdown in a late stage economy, but clearly we didn't foresee what would happen relative to the fast-paced global pandemic. Again, you know, the fifth pandemic in some 20 years. But we reminded all of our investors that everybody had 3 to 5 years of safe money, 3 to 5 years of bonds and cash tucked away. And we did that because we know the only way individual investors would ever be injured is if they were forced to sell when prices are low. And having that safe money allows everybody that's gotten retired to ensure that they stay retired. And in our core models, the strategic ETF, global ETF, income base, the other mutual fund cores, you've noticed changes that have been implemented. Trades on the 27th of February, 28th of February, March 6th, March 9th, March 10th. We've done things with scale because the professional investor does things with scale. And while none of those changes are going to stop losses from occurring in markets that quickly go into free fall, as I look back now, the improvements we made in credit, the elevated levels of cash and fixed income in accounts, well, it's limited the drawdown relative to what other investors are experiencing right now in the market. And more importantly, it provides us a systematic blueprint and process to redeploy that capital in stages to take advantage of the weaknesses that others will probably continue to create. We've been here every day, every night. We'll continue to be here throughout this crisis. And I think we have to call that a crisis. It's not just about the economy. It's about healthcare. And we'll do everything to protect you and your family that's within our means. But I want to turn the table and really talk about investing. I want to talk about the economy. And there is no better person to help us do that than a guest that we have had to our audience before, Jack Janasiewicz, CFA, one of the largest global asset managers on the planet. And I invite Jack now, as I turn the call over to him, to talk a little bit about where we are in the economy, where we might be in the markets and just provide commentary on his thoughts and outlook and relative to what his firm has been doing for institutional clients, which I think is going to parallel closely how we've been reducing risk for clients that we represent. With that, Jack, I turn the call over to you.
All right, great. Thanks, Craig, and I appreciate the opportunity to work with you and your clients at the Wealth Management Group. I think a couple of things I wanted to start off to highlight, because I think it's very important to try to give some context in terms of how we're thinking about things. And you had mentioned at the beginning there your comments about Warren Buffett and taking the 1-2 punch. I find that pretty apropos. And in this case, I would actually say you might throw one more punch on top of that. So we actually took three punches, I think, more recently. And the confluence of all those events coming all at the same time, I think, is really what's pressuring the market. And this is something we haven't really seen in quite some time. To kind of couch those three sort of punches that we're talking about, we've had a supply shock, a demand shock, and an oil shock. The supply shock is really in reference to the China supply chain issues on the back of the coronavirus when it first started to come out of the Chinese economy. The second one is sort of a derivative of the coronavirus, which is basically the coronavirus fear itself. And that's really created a demand shock where people are just getting a little bit concerned about going out and potentially contracting the virus. And as a result, we're seeing somewhat of some retrenchment, whether that be on the, going out on a Friday night and going out to dinner, going out to the movies, whatever that may be. We are certainly seeing some of that coming through. So we've got both a supply shock and a demand shock. And I know from my 25-plus years of investing, typically you don't get two of these at the same time. And historically, we tend to get just the demand shock. And the demand shock tends to be something that can be easily addressed, which typically is done through the Fed cutting rates, lowering the cost of credit. That makes it a little bit easier to access and credit more available, and demand starts to react to that and basically comes back online, and as a matter of time, it tends to come right back. But when you combine both of these shocks at the same time, both a supply shock and a demand shock, that's something that really is pretty forceful, and that's something that we're not used to seeing. I would then say layer on top of this the oil shock, and now you've got three major things that have hit the U.S. economy and the global markets. And that in and of itself, I think, is something that we weren't ready for. And obviously, asset prices have reacted accordingly. But I think there's something that's very interesting that is really at play here that's exacerbating some of the price action we're seeing in financial markets. And I spend a lot of time focusing on investor psychology. And I think there's a few things I wanted to highlight with regard to investor psychology and how that plays into what's really happening right now. And the first thing I wanted to touch on is a concept called probability neglect. And that concept is basically saying we spend a lot of time focusing on some pretty outsized results, and those outsized results tend to sort of blind us from the idea of what are the probability, what are the odds of that outsized result actually hitting. And if we think about the lottery, I think the lottery is a pretty good example of this, because it tends to it really leverages on the concept of that concept of probability neglect. And if you think about something like Powerball, for example, one of the big jackpots that runs across multi-states, the odds of you actually winning the Powerball jackpot, it's one in close to 300 million. And when you start to see the jackpot growing up to, that one that hit for $1.5 billion, you can start to see the people queuing up in the lines and really getting excited about getting a ticket. You might spend a couple hours waiting in line to get that ticket. But we're really sucked in by the allure of that huge payout hitting. But in reality, getting those numbers to come up, a one in almost 300 million opportunity, very low odds. And I think this really is what I think we're seeing in the marketplace today. And let me put some context around this. I think the Diamond Princess is a pretty good example, right? That's the cruise line that was infected and effectively quarantined offshore for quite some time. There were roughly 3,700 passengers on the Diamond Princess, and of those, about 706 of them were actually tested positive, actually contracted the virus. of that 706, only six actually died as a result of that. And so if you sort of work backwards through the math of when you think about everybody being on that cruise line, that's a nice example of what I would consider to be a small ecosystem that is basically in a highly contagious ecosystem. And within that sort of environment, 0.8% of the people that actually contracted the virus died from it. If we then actually move that farther back and say, well, how many people in total on the boat actually died from the virus, it's less than 0.2%. So, again, a microcosm, and this is probably some a little bit of an exaggerated example because you've got 3,700 people on a boat that can't go anywhere. And if we sort of think of that sort of the worst-case scenario for us, the odds of you contracting the virus are still pretty low, and then the odds of you passing away from that are even lower. And yet it certainly feels like the market is focusing on that sort of one big outlier. And this is sort of, I think, that concept of probability neglect kicking in. Now, listen, I'm not trying to belittle this, and it's certainly a very important backdrop, because we're dealing with something that we quite frankly don't know a lot about. We don't know a lot about it. We don't know how it's translated. We don't understand how it's transmitted. We don't understand, some of the ways it attacks the system. We're slowly getting ideas and data around this. But the unknown, I think, is what's making this very tricky. And the other thing is the end result, if we do get something wrong on this and you contract it, the odds are you're still pretty low, but the outcome is very devastating, i.e. death. So it certainly is something that is not to be taken lightly, but the odds of this really actually having a significant impact is, I think, being lost in all of the concerns that are out there. And then if we layer on top of this the other behavioral science aspect, which is the media amplification of risk, that certainly doesn't make this thing any better. And, obviously every night when you sit down and watch the news, this is the major topic of headlines. And, of course, that's what the press wants to report on. It's what sells rights. It sells the advertising. That's what people want to see. And this sort of just perpetuates throughout the system. And fear breeds fear. And as a result, I think that is having another outsized impact on what we're seeing with regard to asset prices. So if we sort of bring all this back to full circle, how do we get through this? What are we looking for to get past this? Well, there's a couple of things that I think really are very important to focus on. And we sort of look at three different things when we look at that checklist. How do we get through this? How do we get to the other side? Well, to me, all of this really resonates around the idea of confidence. And confidence in the idea that, one, we actually have a handle on the virus, and two, the healthcare system actually has a handle on the virus and can handle the outbreak in and of itself. And for us on the confidence side, the confirmed cases in the United States need to at some point level off. If you look at the typical curves in terms of new cases relative to the number of weeks into the outbreak, you can see a certain pattern, and historically that has been taking shape. We've seen the numbers in Korea and Singapore and China following what we call the epi curve. So if we sort of follow along those same lines, it wouldn't be surprising if within the next 3 or 4 weeks, the U.S. actually starts to hit that peak in the cases of confirmed, and then we start to roll over on the back of that. But the point being, probably when we get to that level where we see the confirmed cases no longer increasing, that's when you're going to start to see some confidence coming back. And secondly, you're also going to see when we can prove that we have the testing kits available, and when we have all the ability at the hospitals that the healthcare system can handle this, I think that will actually start to calm some of these fears down too. So there's a confidence issue right now that I think we will slowly get ourselves through. And then the second and third thing on the back of that is also going to be the fiscal and monetary policy response. And we've already started to see some of that. We had the U.S. Federal Reserve cut 50 basis points the other day. They're also in charge of making sure that the interbank markets are functioning appropriately. I think when you look at what happened back in 2007, 2008, during the financial crisis, we learned some valuable lessons as a result of that. And one of the big issues that came out of that was really the plumbing of the financial system started to clog up. And that reverberated through the system and actually had some significant adverse impacts. The Fed is well aware of this, and as a result, they don't want this to happen again. And so far, they've taken some proactive steps to make sure that that plumbing channel does not get clogged up again, and they're doing actually a pretty good job with this. So we continue to monitor the interbank funding markets. They seem to be doing okay right now. No big alarms being thrown up. So the Fed is doing its job with regard to monetary policy and helping to make sure that the banks continue to function properly. And then the third one is the fiscal response. And we're starting to see some signs that over this past weekend, or over the coming weekend, we might get some sort of a fiscal deal on the government side through Congress. So, listen, we've started to see some turning points. As I had mentioned, that checklist, the confidence, the fiscal and the monetary policy side, we're starting to see signs that those are beginning to be addressed. We had some significant announcements coming from the European side of the equation over the last few days. That, I think, is also very important. And all we're trying to do is basically stem that sort of declining risk sentiment backdrop. And the more recent announcements that are coming from these key public figures are certainly helping to put some confidence back in the market that it's being addressed, not taken lightly. And as a result, that's giving us a little bit more confidence moving forward and really preventing this from turning into a bigger shock than that. On the oil front side, there's a couple of things that I think are quite interesting to address. And again, that's that 1-2-3 punch that we were referring to at the beginning. So we've kind of talked about the coronavirus supply demand shock portion, that really being a function of investor sentiment. The oil shock thing is a little bit different. We saw the OPEC Russia breakdown over the past weekend. And on the back of that, Saudi Arabia decided to start to push the production of oil up. And obviously, when supply starts to increase, we tend to start to see oil prices react negatively as a result. And we saw an outsized move as a result of the announcements on the Saudi Arabia side of the equation. But I think there's a little bit of saber rattling going on here and some political jockeying. Russia couldn't come to an agreement on OPEC production cuts. And again, Russia is actually not part of OPEC. It's OPEC Plus. So Russia sits outside, but more recently has agreed to work with OPEC. And the fact that Russia decided to sort of not play along with OPEC really, I think, upset the Saudi Arabians. And as a result, sort of wanted to teach the Russians a lesson. But when you start to see oil pushing down close to $30 a barrel, there are some ramifications for the global system, in particular the U.S. equity markets. And I think when you have any sort of big price moves in the marketplace, whether it be fixed income, commodities, equities, the market participants simply don't like to see that. It's something that is uncertain. When you have these sort of sharp changes, that certainly adversely impacts risk sentiment, and you have to adjust accordingly. And that, coupled with the other shocks that we had talked about, just didn't come at the right time. But if we sort of think about what the impact from lower oil prices are and why we're having that adverse impact, shale is a pretty big component of U.S. GDP. If you look at the contribution from the shale industry, if you think of it in regards to the number of people that are employed in the shale industry, it's sizable. So if lower oil prices start to force the shale players to shut down, you could very well see some layoffs there. And obviously, with the U.S. economy being a consumption economy, the feed through from less people being employed would certainly hurt. And I think the other thing that's very interesting, when we start to see these lower oil prices, CapEx starts to dry up. CapEx on the energy and mining side of the equation in the United States is fairly significant, and that starts to matter as well. And so if we start to see lower oil prices, that discourages a lot of players to invest going forward, and that tends to become a drag as well. And then the third thing, a lot of the regional banks are lenders to the shale community. And as a result, if the shale community comes under some stress with lower oil prices, that's going to filter through into the banking side of the equation, put some pressure on some of the regional banks that are lending to them. So you have three shocks that are hitting all at the same time. That's been denting confidence in the market. It's been denting risk appetite. But we are starting to see some signs that we're getting a response to that. And as I mentioned, confidence is key. We're getting a fiscal response. We're getting a monetary policy response. Now we just need to get the healthcare response. And it certainly seems like that's starting to turn for us as well. So a lot of bad news, a lot of headlines, a lot of hits on the price side of the equation. The markets are certainly trying to get their arms around this and sort of get a better handle on risk in their portfolios. And it's certainly the uncertainty of those three things hitting all at once is not surprising that we had this outsized reaction. But as the market sort of settles in and gets a better grip in terms of what's going on, we're starting to see things turning for the better. And I think the those three things, the confidence, the fiscal and the monetary policy response, and now it's become much more coordinated, not just here in the United States, but obviously overseas. That's a very powerful component. And at a certain point here, we're probably going to get to that inflection point. And if we think about the other side, when we sort of come out of the back of this, you know, we came into the beginning of this year pretty optimistic on the global economy and especially the U.S. economy. And the amount of stimulus that was actually being in place at the beginning of this year has only certainly been added to as a result. And so we certainly would not be discounting this to be prolonged. And when we look to the other side of the equation, when we start to get a recovery here, there's plenty of sort of ingredients that would really mix together quite well for a pretty sharp recovery through the second half of this year, and that's sort of what we're looking for. So with that, I will flip it back over to Craig and see if you guys have any questions.
No, well, Jack, thank you so much for your comments, and I am, you know, enticed by the fact there are some core ingredients for what could be a recovery in place once we get through. Again, this is about health care right now. It's not so much about the rest. I totally agree with that point. But you're right. Low oil prices, fiscal stimulus that's coming, monetary stimulus that's already here, reasonable valuations, the list goes on and on and on. But the bottom line is, I think investors, we always anchor back to that through which we experienced recently. And you began our call by spending a little bit of time talking about behavioral finance, cognitive biases, etc. And when I think back to 1929, when I think back to 08 and 09, those issues were caused by massive amounts of leverage and speculation in different forms. We didn't have that going in. Can you explain why this is most likely not an 08-09 scenario, why this is not a 1929 scenario? It is an event-driven bear market that just occurred. Those are very, very different. Briefly explain the context.
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of concern, a lot of parallels that are trying to be drawn with some of those key sort of events that happened in from a historical perspective. And this time around, I think it's we have to put some context around that. And 07-08 to me is something that's very interesting, and it has to do with the amount of leverage in the system. And just to understand what leverage is simply borrowing to then reinvest somewhere else. And if we think about if I borrow a dollar and then invest that dollar in something, then I could take that asset and lend that asset out and get some money in return and then buy something else. And then I'd keep doing that over and over again, where in effect, if I had $1 and did this 14 times, I now could have $14 worth of investments, but all I have to do is carry basically $1 on my book. That's the compounding of the leverage issue. And when we look back at 2007-2008, financial institutions, in particular a lot of the big banks, their trading proprietary books all had this sort of leverage in them. And a lot of the leverage was also tied to the mortgage-backed security market, which is tied to the housing market. And when the housing market actually started to roll over, you start to get the adverse impact on the mortgage market. You see prices fall. And then as a result of risk management, when those prices begin to fall, all these leveraged trades have to sort of unwind. And then when you have that size of a leveraged trade that needs to get unwound, you can see the ripple effect it has throughout the rest of the financial community. That, I think, in itself changed how we're looking at things today, because a lot of the policies and regulations put into place today are a result of what we learned from 07-08, and that was we can't have these massive institutions taking on this amount of risk, because when things go bad, it has significant ramifications for the economy. And as a result, regulations prevent banks from doing this sort of thing. So when you look at the amount of leverage that was in the system in 2007-2008, it was enormous. We don't have that today because of the regulations that have been put into place. And so that liquidation event, which is basically I have to sell anything and everything to get my hands on because I need cash to basically pay off people, that's not what's going on today. And that's a very, very big difference because when you're looking at today versus back then, that leverage multiplier is simply not in the marketplace and you don't have that sort of forced selling for cash going on right now.
No, I think those are great comments. Absolutely. And to all of our clients on the call, we stay with the plan. We follow the process. We understand that everyone's goal and our shared goal can be boiled down to getting retired, to staying retired, and that has not been put into jeopardy. That has not been threatened because we already have bonds, cash, and other things that we can utilize. And yes, the market has rewarded those that have bought the dips all the way along in the last 11 years. This has turned out, though, to be one heck of a dip. And our job is not to call market tops. Our job is not to call market bottoms. Our job is to make really good decisions for everybody's intermediate to long term, but to make those decisions based on probabilities, not possibilities. And to the extent that we can see some follow-through, to the extent that we can see two back-to-back days of strong, returned buying enthusiasm, where 80 to 90% of the stocks close on their highs in the day, that'll be a good sign that some of that selling pressure is exhausted, and we'll be able to redeploy some of that capital. But in the meantime, if you have questions, if your family has concerns, reach out and call. As I said at the beginning of this call, for the last 3.5 weeks, we have been here day and night. Whether it takes another 3.5 weeks, another 3.5 months, it does not matter. We will work tirelessly for you to accomplish your goals. Your goals are our goals. It is that through which we exist to serve, to help be wonderful stewards of your family's financial plans. So, from our family to yours, stay healthy, be cautious, continue to pursue life, and there is going to be plenty of opportunity to invest and buy great companies of America, those companies with wide moats, strong balance sheets, competitive advantages, those companies that don't just drive dividends, but those companies that have a history of increasing their dividends. And I have to admit, I get excited about that because it almost puts an acronym we discussed several years ago back in play, and that acronym is TINA. It's not a person, it's a concept. There is no alternative. And again, I don't think buying government bonds for 10 years at less than 1% is a viable alternative. Bonds will have their place, just like stocks have always had their place, but we have to look at this through the lens of opportunity as well. So to that extent, Jack, we appreciate your partnership. We appreciate your insight. Thank you for keeping all the Wealth Management Group families abreast of the big picture items. To everybody on the Wealth Management Group team, I appreciate you doing what it is that you do best, which is staying visible, making things happen. And to all of our clients, thank you for the trust that you have placed in us. We know that trust is earned through the demonstration of competency, and we'll continue to deliver just that. Lisa, I'll let you conclude the call now.
Thank you, Craig. The opinions voiced on this call are for the general information only and are not intended to provide or be construed as providing specific investment advice or recommendations for any individual security. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Natixis is not affiliated with LPL Financial or Wealth Management Group. Thank you.